Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, December 2nd, 2016. The right-wing assault on freedom of expression, academic freedom, and the right to criticize the state of Israel. Oh, it is growing. And under a President Trump and an Attorney General Sessions, it can only get worse. Well, the Senate, in a rare move, unanimously approved a bill on Thursday aimed at limiting the free speech rights of college students who express support for Palestinians. By unanimous consent, the Senate quietly passed the so-called Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. It was introduced 48 hours earlier by Bob Casey, an alleged Democrat from Pennsylvania, and Tim Scott, the Republican from South Carolina. And it embraces the State Department's broad, widely criticized definition of what is anti-Semitism. That definition, from a memo back in 2010, includes examples like delegitimizing Israel, demonizing Israel, applying double standards to Israel, and focusing on Israel only for peace or human rights investigations. Now, that is very broad language, and it's troubling because it really and clearly enters into the political arena. Anti-Semitism is an expression of hate for persons of Jewish heritage or religious practice. And to broaden that, to provide this umbrella for the state of Israel and its supporters, is deeply insulting to people who believe in honest interpretation of language and the First Amendment of the Constitution. Now, they say that it doesn't quite adopt that legal standard from the State Department. It just, or from the past, it just directs the State Department to take it into consideration. But as I mentioned in the intro, under a Trump Sessions regime, the interpretation of this is not going to be friendly to the critics of the state of Israel. This is going to suppress freedom of expression in very serious ways. And it's troubling that it passed without much debate that I'm aware of and with no opposition. There was one vote not tallied. Bernie Sanders is on a book tour, and I believe he did not participate in the vote in Washington yesterday. In addition, we have the looming problems that have surfaced just in the last week or so. There is the prop or no prop, or prop or not, I guess it's called. Prop is short for propaganda. This was launched in an article by the Washington Post in about the same week that Marty Baron, the editor of the Post, took an award, the Christopher Hitchens Award, that was mostly for his work at the Boston Globe, where, to his credit, he led the team that exposed the pedophilia and the cover-up by the Boston Archdiocese that led to the movie Spotlight, which won an Academy Award. But the same Marty Baron was tweeting and promoting the article about prop or not that didn't identify the source of this McCarthyite watch list of alleged left-wing propaganda outlets. In addition, we have the professor watch list, which has been established recently by a conservative nonprofit called Turning Point USA. Charlie Kirk is the founder and executive director of Turning Point. He says some of America's college professors are totally out of line, and the list is dedicated to exposing professors who promote anti-American left-wing propaganda in the classroom. But who is the arbiter of this? What information is used to determine who gets placed on this list? My friend Mark Crispin Miller is one of those people, and also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, who was added to the list. Her name is Anthea Butler. She published an op-ed today at The Guardian that I've linked to in the show file for today's podcast. She writes, as a one of handful of religion professors in America who study, write, and teach about conservative Christianity and politics, I am all too aware of the real meaning of the list and its purpose. Promoted by Turning Point USA, The list is not simply designed to expose professors who discriminate. It is designed to silence and smear. Turning Point USA has chapters on over 300 college campuses. I didn't know that. And the professor continues, to combat anything or anyone that doesn't promote or teach with a conservative viewpoint. That's the goal of this organization and its allies. It's an all-out bid to control not only academic freedom in the university setting, but to create a hostile climate for free speech and academic freedom. And the professor closes with this. The irony of all this is that while I'm on the professor watch list, I'm probably one of the few professors in America who encourages the students who take my religious right, my Religious Right in America course, to attend conferences like CPAC and the Value Voters Summit. She goes on to say, when groups like Turning Point USA say that I should be watched because I am advancing a radical agenda in the lecture hall, maybe I should. I'm teaching about their organizations and how conservatives think. Radical indeed. Now, caught up in this same wave, in my estimation, is the bid by Keith Ellison. He is the only Muslim member of Congress, a Democrat from Minneapolis who I know and respect, and I welcome his willingness to step up to chair the Democratic National Committee because he would move it away from the corporate liberal elite right wing but these neoliberals who have captured the control of the party. So now the Anti-Defamation League has decided to do a little defamation, and they have come out in opposition to Keith Ellison as head of the DNC. Now, what role does the Anti-Defamation League have in the internal policies and promotion of the Democratic National Committee? And we know that last summer, and the platform process when Keith Ellison was there representing Bernie Sanders, and they pushed for a plank that would be more moderate about the Democrats' support for the State of Israel and be more balanced about the interests of the Palestinians, well, he lost that struggle. So the Anti-Defamation League is citing a comment that he made in 2010 that they consider to be disqualifying. Here's what he said. The United States foreign policy in the Middle East is governed by what is good or bad through a country of 7 million people, an allusion to Israel. And the head of the Anti-Defamation League, getting into defamation mode, said, his words imply that U.S. foreign policy is based on religiously or national origin-based special interests, rather than simply on America's best interests. Ellison's words raise the specter of age-old stereotypes about Jewish control of our government, a poisonous myth that may persist in parts of the world where intolerance thrives, but has no place in open societies like the U.S. Now, this is rich in irony, because it's not an open society if the Anti-Defamation League can prevent Keith Ellison from chairing the Democratic National Committee. And this is the kind of Orwellian thinking that is moving forward in our country today. Now, as a college student, Keith Ellison wrote some columns for his school newspaper where he defended Minister Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. He also defended the right to voice diverse opinions on Zionism, saying that in opposing an anti-Zionist speaker, the university's position appears to be this: political Zionism is off limits no matter what dubious circumstances Israel was founded under, no matter what the Zionists do to the Palestinians, and no matter what wicked regimes Israel allies itself with, like South Africa. This position is untenable. Now, this is stuff that's 20 years old, and I think it was accurate at the time. But there's also union opposition building to Keith Ellison because they're concerned that it would be a takeover by the liberal allies of Bernie Sanders. So it is interesting to see organized labor, not all of it, but parts of it, close ranks in support of an Israeli move to block the nomination or ascension of Keith Ellison to chair the Democratic National Committee. Now, Rich Trumka of the AFL-CIO has been properly criticized for sending out a recommendation to his members that they either vote for Keith Ellison, abstain, or not vote at all. And I don't support that move either. But that's more of a political muscle move than something driven by the politics of the state of Israel. We have two interesting stories today about San Francisco-based entities that took on the FBI over national security letters and the associated gag orders, and they've kind of won. You may know about Credo Mobile. It is a nonprofit that provides wireless services, and if you subscribe, you get to kick back a portion of the money you pay to Credo every year to a nonprofit that you choose. I think it's a great organization. They received a national security letter in 2013 demanding that they turn over the information of one of their customers, and Credo Mobile resisted. They went to court, and we're only learning about this now. It started back in 2013, and a federal judge here in San Francisco, Susan Eielston, ruled in favor of Credo and said that the FBI had violated the Constitution by accompanying the NSL with a gag order. So I think that this is a very strong development, and it is to the credit of the judge and to Credo that they continued to fight. The other entity that waged a similar battle, and it's probable that Credo didn't know that the Internet Archive, which is also based here in San Francisco, had received a national security letter, including a gag order, and that the leader of the Internet Archive, Brewster Colley, not only refused, but he refused to accept the gag order. And he is celebrating, I guess, a little today. The FBI has folded, rescinding the NSL aimed at the Internet Archive and unsealing the court records rather than risk a ruling that their surveillance orders were illegal. And Colley said, "This is an unqualified success that will help other recipients understand that you can push back on these gag orders." So I'm linking to the article from The Intercept that details this, and it mentions the history of the national security letters going back to the 1980s, the way that their use was exponentially expanded after the Patriot Act broadened the use of national security letters, that the inspectors general of the Justice Department have repeatedly reported widespread abuse of the national security letters, the case of Nick Merrill, the New York Internet service provider, who also resisted and finally last year was released from his gag order. I've contacted Nick Merrill many times to try to get him to tell us that part of the story because I interviewed him while he was under the gag order, but he is remaining silent. I don't know why he chooses to do that. So one other interesting element about these national security letters is that because of one of the clauses of the USA Freedom Act that was passed last year, recipients of an NSL can now challenge the gag order at any time. But the FBI is continuing to send out form letters that tell people they have very limited opportunities to protest the gag order. So a lawyer from the Electronic Frontier Foundation said, "It's a matter of public interest that the FBI continues to issue NSLs that incorrectly inform recipients that their ability to challenge non-disclosure requirements is limited to a single petition per year." So even with the law and the courts trying to limit the FBI, they continue to operate as a rogue agency. That's the way I describe them. There has been an effort to deny entry to the United States by a Canadian freelance journalist, a photojournalist, who was assigned by the Canadian Broadcasting Company to cover the protests at Standing Rock, North Dakota. His name is Ed Wu, last name spelled O-U. He's 30 years old. He has covered wars all around the world. He's had to endure aggressive interrogations at border crossings. But when he attempted to fly from Vancouver to Bismarck, North Dakota, He was held for 6 hours by U.S. immigration authorities in Vancouver and ultimately denied entry. They also took his two cell phones, and it was evident that they apparently switched out the SIM cards and took all of the data that was stored on his phone. And so this is a very troubling episode to see our government detain an individual who they knew was going to cover this protest. And it raises further questions about the Obama administration and why the president has remained silent in the face of these egregious overreaches by law enforcement and the denial of the rights of the Native Americans who are trying to protect their water. So I think that this is an important case. It hasn't seen wide coverage so far, but it is just another example of the creeping police state in this country and the unified effort to suppress the media and prevent disclosure of things that the government is trying to keep under wraps. Also, I'm scheduled in a couple of hours to interview two local elected officials from here in California who just returned from Standing Rock. And if it all goes as scheduled, I'll be releasing that to subscribers before the end of the day today. Every day I like to thank the people who subscribe and support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Let's see who's on the list today. Steve Wozenski, Patrick Garay. He just set up a new monthly subscription. Thank you, Patrick. Benny Alto is a longtime supporter from Oregon. Faith Peoples is a valued supporter, and I appreciate each and every one of you. The holidays are here, and if you do year-end giving, maybe you could consider giving a subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast to a friend or family member. I'd be happy to arrange that for you. Just send an email to peter@peterbcollins.com, and we'll communicate on who you want to send it to, what level of support you want to give, and we'll make the arrangements so that you could give that to somebody and make it a very nice holiday gift. Well, the recount elections that we discussed with Jonathan Simon in our latest in-depth interview are proceeding, but Trump allies have thrown huge legal roadblocks in each of the three states where Jill Stein of the Green Party has launched these recalls. And in Michigan, for example, the state attorney general, a Republican, says that Jill Stein's effort puts Michigan voters at risk of paying millions and potentially losing their voice in the Electoral College in the process. This court cannot allow a dilatory and frivolous request for a recount by an aggrieved party to silence all Michigan votes for president. Well, what he's really asking the court to do in his dilatory and frivolous filing is just run out the clock so that the Electoral College will meet before Michigan's recount is completed. They're doing similar things in Wisconsin, where the Stop Hillary PAC and the Great America PAC went to court, saying that the recount could unjustifiably cast doubt on Trump's victory in the state. Now, Trump is the guy who said the election would be rigged. Trump is the guy who said that there have been millions of voter fraud cases that he thinks caused him to lose the popular vote. He's wrong about that, but his allies don't care. They're doing everything they can to gum this up and prevent an honest count of the votes. And I want to recommend that you look at Greg Palast's most recent recap that he published at Truth Out. There's a link to it in the show file of this of today's podcast. And he goes through some of the issues about how provisional ballots and spoiled ballots don't get counted, how there are overvotes and undervotes in Michigan that don't make sense. There could have been a calibration problem or an intentional miscalibration of the scanners that tabulate votes so that it captured a Trump vote but just barely missed a vote for Clinton. All of these are possible, but without a detailed recount of every ballot that's available on paper, we'll never know. And so it's very clear that I don't want to say very clear, but my fear is at this point that this recount will not produce anything useful, and it certainly won't produce anything in a timely manner before the Electoral College votes. And I regret to say that, but I think that is the case. I also want to recommend that you follow these issues at bradblog.com. My longtime friend Brad Friedman is a real expert on election integrity, and he does a great job covering these matters, and I hope you will check out bradblog.com. So Donald Trump went to my hometown of Cincinnati last night to hold a victory rally. It was truly bizarre. I saw just a few excerpts from it, but mostly he praised himself and slammed the media. He's a creation of the media. Without the excessive coverage that he was given, particularly in the early stages of the primaries, Donald Trump would not be claiming to be president-elect today. And the way he hammers the media, and certainly I believe that the media is at fault, but not for the things that Trump talks about. Trump talks about these personal slights, and they don't run good pictures of him, and, you know, that CNN was unfair. Well, I saw a lot of segments on a lot of networks where people made claims that Donald Trump was unelectable, that there was no chance he'd be elected, and so there certainly was a bias against him. I don't deny that. But the real issue is coming up in some of these postmortems. There was one held at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN, was part of a panel discussion where he took a lot of flack, and he deserves it. CNN did help create the Trump monster. And along with MSDNC and Fox, every time Donald got on the phone, they'd let him rant and rave. Everybody else has to go to a camera somewhere, a remote studio, or show up at the main studio. But they made all these exceptions for Trump. And CNN is having its most profitable year ever, on track to show $1 billion in profit. And so we can see that the media has created this monster, and now the monster has turned on it. And it's hard to know who to root for and who to root against. And in the seminar or the confab that was held in Cambridge, Massachusetts at Harvard, we saw that people like Kellyanne Conway and her Clinton counterpart, Jennifer Palmieri, exchanged some pretty pointed comments. But none of them really acknowledge the real issues here. That the Democrats ran a tragically flawed candidate, a victim of her own self-inflicted wounds, the email scandal, the foundation, just to name two, and that Donald Trump did, in fact, use a race-based campaign to bring out of the woodwork a lot of voters who ordinarily would not participate. And so a lot of this yak after the election is pretty meaningless. But some of it is fun to see. The interesting quote of the day comes from Senator Sherrod Brown, the Democrat from Ohio, responding to the claim that Trump was going to drain the swamp of corruption in Washington, D.C. And Brown said, "This isn't draining the swamp," referring to the cabinet appointments. "It's stocking it with alligators." And I mentioned Jeff Sessions earlier in the podcast. You've got Tom Price dedicated to dismantling Obamacare over at Health and Human Services. You've got the Wall Street pal, the guy who used to work at Goldman Sachs, Steve Mnuchin, heading to the Treasury Department. This monster, Mike Pompeo, a Koch brothers ally who is going to be named director of the CIA. And the latest announcement, which was leaked, denied, leaked, and then confirmed last night, is that General Mike Mattis, also known as Mad Dog Mattis, will be named as the Secretary of Defense. And it's a really mixed bag, and I want to credit my old friend Marjorie Cohn. She's a retired law professor from San Diego, and at Truth Out today, I've linked to the story, she offers a pretty balanced view of General Mattis. He is a bloodthirsty militarist, and he led the assault on Fallujah in Iraq in 2005, and afterward he declared it's fun to shoot some people. That was a year, says Cohn, after he oversaw that battle, and 736 people were killed. At least 60% of them were women and children. He also supports collective punishment, which is a war crime. And when you apply that to Fallujah, it is the targeting of civilians, and it does rise to the level of a war crime. Now, what's interesting is that he opposed the deal with Iran, but has advised Donald Trump not to scuttle it. And likewise, Cohn writes, to his credit, Mattis has been clear-eyed about blowback from U.S. policy on Israel. He noted the U.S. is paying a security price in the Middle East because we are considered biased in favor of Israel. Here's a quote. I paid a military security price every day as commander of CENTCOM because the Americans were seen as biased in support of Israel. The other thing that's notable is that General Mattis opposes torture because he believes it doesn't work. And maybe he can knock some sense into the orange hair on that particular subject. In a largely symbolic move, but one that gives more ammo to Donald Trump after January 20th, the Senate, on a 99-0 vote yesterday, agreed to extend the presidential authority to impose sanctions on Iran. And this, I say, is largely symbolic, but it does give an arrow in the proverbial quiver to Trump if he decides to crack down on Iran. The United Nations and Ban Ki-moon, the outgoing leader there of the General Assembly, he gave a speech and he gave a narrowly worded apology to the people of Haiti, acknowledging the United Nations' role in failing to address the cholera outbreak that has killed over 10,000 people in Haiti in the last 6 years. But he came short of acknowledging that the UN was responsible for introducing cholera to Haiti, which we know came in through the peacekeepers who were dispatched from Nepal. I want to respond to some feedback from listeners. I can't remember this person's name, but on Twitter, he or she uses the handle Twisted Politics. And Twisted Politics tweeted the other day a reminder that today is the one-year anniversary of the deadly shooting spree in San Bernardino, California. And I generally don't cover stories just based on the calendar and anniversaries. But Twisted Politics reminded me that I had published a list of 13 unanswered questions about the investigation into the San Bernardino shooting. What happened to the third shooter? How do you square the eyewitness accounts of three tall, male, white shooters with the 90-pound, 5'3" female accused, whose name is Tashfeen Malik? How did the active shooter drill that was underway have any connection to the events of that day? The Facebook post, and this is the most outrageous part of it. The FBI leaked the information and never provided a transcript or a copy that Tashfeen Malik had made a Facebook post where she pledged allegiance to al-Baghdadi of the Islamic State either during or just after the shooting spree. It's a year later. We have never seen any proof of that, and I consider it to be total bullshit. And the U.S. media just fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Also, that same post, we're told, was made at or near the start of the shooting, but that she only had a burner phone. So how did she post on Facebook with a burner phone? You can't do it. We also raised questions about the news chopper video of the final shootout scene that's very different from the dramatic still photos that are shown with a hood raised and the vehicle all shot up. We never saw dash cam videos of that scene. And there are other questions that continue to linger today, and nobody's interested in that anymore. It's all solidified. The story has gelled. You can't ask any questions about it, and it is routinely used as a reason to support more surveillance, draconian police state activities in this country. And if we don't get to the bottom of the facts of these events, they will continue to be used against our constitutional rights. That's what I'm seeing. Also, I want to thank a number of people who have responded recently. Andy Drawl, who is a Bay Area listener, responded to my list of the 9 ways that Obama set the stage for the Trump election with his own list of 6 additional reasons, mostly based on employment and economics, of why Obama set the stage for a Trump victory. Andy, I appreciate your smart input there. Also, in recent days, I've gotten a lot of feedback, critical feedback, about my coverage of Yasha Levine at Pando. And Yasha is the reporter who has been critical of the encryption system called Tor, and also an audio encryption system called Signal. And both my webmaster, John Gorenfeld, and listener George Mashke had strong responses. And first, John Gorenfeld, who is my webmaster, a very bright guy. I've always been skeptical of the Pando anti-crypto line. The math is insanely unbreakable. I know it's all a DARPA project, and every now and then there's a government backdoor. But in a recent exercise in code breaking and asking my Mac to calculate how long it would take to crack a key of mine, I was given a time estimate of the age of the universe. Okay. So John Gorenfeld is a big believer in encryption. He says this Torgate campaign of Pando's he said it seems like something that Mark Ames, one of the founders of Pando, dreamed up in an opium haze in between sexually harassing Russian women. Ames used to run a publication in Moscow. But he closes by saying, those Snowden slides say it all. The NSA admits it can't hack Tor. Even when you read about secret rooms at AT&T and Yahoo where the NSA steals your email, that's in the much easier world of snooping on unencrypted data or data that you trust to be encrypted by someone else only to find out that someone else is sharing the keys with the NSA. And he closes by saying Levine's inability to come up with many technical details is also telling. Then George Mashke, who is a listener, he was once interviewed on this program. He is based in the Netherlands. And he writes, I was dismayed to hear you spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt about the most robust anonymity and privacy tools available, Tor and Signal. Yasha Levine insinuates that Tor is untrustworthy because it began as a U.S. Navy research project and continues to receive public funding. But this is no dark, deep secret, he says. Moreover, the fact that Tor has had exploitable bugs does not mean that Tor is backdoored for the United States government. Vulnerabilities in the Tor browser are promptly patched as they are discovered. Note that such vulnerabilities have largely affected only users of Windows, not Mac OS or Linux. Most importantly, Tor is open source. Its code is open for public review. No one has ever found a government backdoor in it. I'm not sure about that. Indeed, Tor poses a formidable obstacle to mass surveillance. With respect to Signal, it too is open source, has been peer-reviewed. No backdoor has ever been shown to exist. In response to a recent subpoena for a Signal user's data, Open Whisper Systems could provide only the date and time of the user's last connection and the date and time the user's account was created. No information on other details. He goes on, Yasha Levine's critique of Tor and Signal consists of vague innuendo based on little more than the fact that both projects receive public funding. This is shoddy journalism. Well, I respect your opinion, George, and I thank you for writing, and I will leave it to listeners to decide whether they trust encryption systems or not. Thank you for joining me for this free news and comment podcast, available daily on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.